This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 23rd of April, these are our main stories. US prosecutors have accused Donald Trump of a conspiracy over hush money paid to a porn actress at the start of his criminal trial in New York. Police in Ecuador have caught the leader of a powerful criminal gang at the heart of a wave of violence that's destabilized the country. And a UN report into the Palestinian refugee agency UNRWA has concluded it must do more to improve its neutrality and transparency. Also in this podcast, the search for five raccoons who've been on the run from a zoo in the Netherlands for more than a month.
They saw like deers and otters and a beaver, and yeah, they really had good nights seeing all those animals, but no raccoons.
New York is hosting one of the most high-profile trials in United States history, the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president. Day one of the trial proper ended on Monday in Manhattan, where Donald Trump stands accused of 34 counts of falsifying business records. They relate to a $130,000 payment made to the porn actress Stormy Daniels to silence her about her allegation that she and Mr. Trump had a sexual encounter. It isn't the payment itself that's said to be illegal, but the way it was described in Mr. Trump's accounts. As he arrived at court, Mr. Trump made a series of evidence-free and, in some cases, factually wrong assertions.
I just want to say before we begin, these are all Biden trials. This is done as election interference. Everybody knows it. I'm here instead of being able to be in Pennsylvania and Georgia and lots of other places campaigning. And it's very unfair. Fortunately, the poll numbers are very good. They've been going up because people understand what's going on. This is a witch hunt, and it's a shame. And it comes out of Washington. It's in coordination with Washington, everything, including the DA's office. It's in coordination with Washington. I just want people to understand that this is done for purposes of hurting the opponent of the worst president in the history of our country. What's going on right here should never be happening. It's a very, very sad day in America, I can tell you that.
The seven men and five women of the jury heard the prosecution and the defense outline their cases. Prosecutors spoke about a catch-and-kill policy allegedly orchestrated by the former president. So what's the significance of that? A question for our correspondent Neda Taufik in New York.
Catch and kill means essentially to buy stories, but not to publish them, to kill them so they don't reach the voting public. And this is really central to the prosecution's case, because essentially what they say is there was a criminal conspiracy and then there was a cover-up. The criminal conspiracy, they say, was to try to influence the 2016 election. And they say this catch and kill scheme was so important because after that infamous Access Hollywood tape where Donald Trump was heard bragging about grabbing women's genitals because he was famous, when that came out, his campaign was in panic mode, and therefore buying Stormy Daniels' story to, again, catch and kill it was a way to shield him from any negative impact that could have on him further with female voters in particular. And that's why prosecutors started with bringing the first witness, who was the owner of the National Enquirer, which is a tabloid newspaper that kind of helped in that scheme.
His name is David Pecker, isn't it? Tell us a little bit more about him.
David Pecker is the owner of American Media Group. He owned several different tabloids, and he just started on the witness stand, just giving some biographical information about himself. But prosecutors said that he will testify that he spoke directly with Donald Trump about this scheme and getting reimbursed for a payment he made to a former Playboy model, Karen McDougal, who also alleges she had an affair with Donald Trump, which he denies, and also a doorman who was also trying to sell a story about Donald Trump, which turned out to be false. But essentially, they are going through. He talks about how usually they would pay $10,000 for a tabloid story, but here he paid more than $150,000 to Karen McDougal, again, in coordination, allegedly, with Donald Trump's campaign to kind of get rid of that negative story. So he, for prosecutors, is a key kind of cooperating witness Brooks, and he is just meant to add strength to their case, along with Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former lawyer, and some of the business records that they're going to be presenting as evidence.
And what are the defense arguments, Netta?
Well, the defense, keep in mind, they are just there to really sow doubt in jurors' minds, because the burden of proof is on the prosecution in this case. So Todd Blanche, Donald Trump's lawyer, first argued that there's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy, he said. He also said that Donald Trump was so high up in the organization that he had nothing to do with how these payments were recorded in corporate records. I think it's important for listeners to remember that Donald Trump has acknowledged reimbursing Michael Cohen, but he really denies kind of directing the scheme at all. He says it was more about saving his family from personal embarrassment. So his lawyers have really been trying to sow doubt in every point of the prosecutor's arguments here.
Netta Taufik in New York. Police in Ecuador have captured one of the country's most wanted people. Fabricio Colon Pico is the leader of a powerful criminal gang known as Los Lobos. It's estimated 8,000 members are said to have played a major role in destabilizing Ecuador. The arrest comes a day after a referendum on increasing police power to tackle violent crime. Monica Palencia is the Ecuadorian Interior Minister.
Some time ago, we broke the unfortunate news of Colon Pico's escape from Cotopaxi prison. And today, we have recaptured him. We all know who Colon Pico is. He's a symbol. And the national police have never ceased searching for him.
Our South America correspondent Ione Wells, speaking from a busy place in Quito, told us more about Fabricio Colon Pico and his original escape from prison.
He was one of more than 30 prisoners that escaped from Riobamba prison on the 8th of January, and this was part of a kind of wave of prison riots, violent attacks which took place in prisons at the start of this year. The prison service at the time said that he had basically taken advantage of chaos that had been created by rioting that was going on within the prisons to essentially just walk out of jail at the time. 20 of the inmates who had escaped were quickly rearrested, but he was one who managed to basically avoid being found for months and months and months. So he has been on the run since January, essentially, and has been one of the most wanted people in the whole country.
So tell us about the recapture.
Police haven't given a huge amount of information at the moment, but they say that they have found him. He had dyed his hair as part of a disguise to try and stop himself being found, but they have now recaptured him. And I think the sort of hope is that this will be seen as quite a big win for the security services in Ecuador, although certainly one concern I think that there will be is that in the past, when high-up gang members have been arrested or have faced punishments from the authorities, that has sometimes led to further outbreaks of violence or rioting in itself.
Tell us a little bit more about the gang Los Lobos.
Well, Los Lobos is one of the most powerful, influential criminal gangs in Ecuador. It has about 8,000 members. It's thought to have a lot of links to a powerful gang in Mexico as well, one of the biggest drug cartels there. Ecuador in general has seen its homicide rate, its sort of rate of kidnappings and other violent crimes increase significantly in the last couple of years, and that has partly been attributed to criminal gangs like Los Lobos, who have unleashed really spates of violent attacks, particularly in big cities, but also in port cities like Guayaquil in Ecuador, which is one of the major ports. It's where a lot of goods like bananas get shipped to the US and to Europe. And that makes it a really sort of ripe area for drug cartels to move in because they can stash drugs in a lot of those international shipments.
How big a blow to Los Lobos will Fabricio Colon Pico's arrest be?
I think it will be a big blow. He is the leader, he's one of the most powerful members, and his gang has wielded huge amounts of influence in the country in the last couple of years. His gang has been accused of planning some of the most high-profile murders, including the murder last year of one of the presidential candidates, Fernando Villavicencio. So I think the loss of its leader will be a blow to the gang. However, the sheer amount of members that it has means they are still strong in the country. They still wield a lot of power. So there are questions really about whether the arrest of just one member, one significant leader like this, will really be enough to dent the power of a criminal gang like that.
Ione Wells. Earlier this year, an Israeli intelligence report alleged that some staff of UNRWA, the UN agency providing aid to Palestinians, had been involved in the October the 7th attacks on Israel by Hamas. The US and several other countries cut payments to the agency in response. Now, an independent review into UNRWA's neutrality has said it has robust frameworks in place, but still has work to do to improve its vetting and transparency. The report's author is a former Foreign Minister of France, Catherine Colonna.
Coming to our recommendations, some, and these are just a few examples, include regularly sharing the list of employees, digitalized with some details of the employees, with host countries and with Israel. It works well in some countries, less with Israel. In the past years, it could have been better, but in the very recent times, this is affected, of course, by the global atmosphere.
The BBC's Geneva correspondent Imogen Folks has seen the report.
It is not a glowing endorsement of UNRWA. It says that despite it having very rigorous operating procedures in place, it should do more in vetting of staff and in upholding those key humanitarian principles of impartiality and neutrality. What it says, though, is that UNRWA itself tries very hard to do this, but it needs more support from donor countries and from the bodies that it has to work with, and that includes Israel and the Israeli military and the Palestinian Authority.
And what did it say about Israel?
Well, there's a key finding here which will not please Israel, and that is we know that Israel alleges, in addition to specific allegations that 12 UNRWA staff participate in the October 7th attacks, and that is the subject, I have to say, of a separate investigation, Israel has alleged that thousands of UNRWA staff members are also members of Hamas or are supportive of it or are involved in it. And this report says that Israel has yet to provide any supportive evidence for those claims. We had Israel's reaction to that, which says this UN report is a cosmetic exercise and hasn't looked at the really deep-rooted problems.
Now, multiple countries pulled their funding of UNRWA after the allegations were made. What sort of impact did that have on the organisation's work?
It has made the agency even more cash-strapped than it was already. I mean, I think we have to be realistic. All UN agencies, aid agencies, are cash-strapped at the moment because of the number of crises we have. But it is now operating on a shoestring, and a shoestring that's very short. So UNRWA does need, if it is to continue doing what it does, running hospitals, running schools, supplying humanitarian aid, it needs that funding back, particularly from the United States and the United Kingdom. Now, the UN has been hoping that the depth of this report, the fact that the UN itself has accepted all the recommendations and will implement them, including more transparency, stronger vetting, more emphasis on neutrality, that this will encourage donors to restore that funding.
That was Imogen Folks. Well, as we heard in the earlier podcast, a senior Israeli figure has resigned in the wake of the October the 7th attacks. Major General Aharon Chaliva was the chief of the military intelligence service. The IDF said he'd formally stepped down as soon as his successor was chosen. Amir Avivi is a brigadier general in the Israeli reserves and a former deputy commander of the Gaza division. He is the founder and chairman of the Israel Defense and Security Forum. Rebecca Kesby asked him if he was surprised by the timing of General Khalifa's resignation.
Well, I think that there is an explanation regarding the timing. There is the alleged attack of Israel in Syria. Iranian general was killed. And the assessment of the same Khalifa and his organization was that Iran is not going to retaliate. Of course, they got this also wrong. And at this stage, in Israel, there were many articles by many prominent people in Israel saying, okay, that's it.
Let's look at what happened on the specifically the 7th of October, because there were so many warnings ahead of this happening that have come to light. The BBC spoke to observers, I think they're called, in the IDF, who had been warning for months that the Hamas was planning something. But it wasn't just the security failings on the day. It was also failure in the response of what happened on the day that shocked so many Israelis. What did go wrong? Just remind us.
Well, I can tell you that my organization presented 2 years ago a national security assessment to the government and the army, saying war is imminent and it will happen in the coming 2 years. We saw this coming. For us, it was crystal clear. Cannot understand how, with all the intelligence and everything that Khalifa and the whole intelligence apparatus of the army had, they couldn't see it coming. I think there was a lot of information, but when you have a certain worldview, you process this information in a way that you simply disregard everything that is said, and this is what happened.
Well,
there
was a lot of information,
and by the way, not only the observers.
Is that an excuse, though? I mean, given the very serious nature of defending Israel?
Not at all. I think it's a huge failure, probably the bigger one Israel has ever had. And the amount of soldiers and the level of readiness you had along the border was connected to the intelligence. And because there was no warning at all, and nobody expected anything, there were a certain amount of troops in the border. And the attack, today we know it's between 4,000 to 5,000 terrorists that attacked in 70 different places.
And what about the response, though? Because we heard from people who said that they were waiting for the IDF or even the police to turn up, and it took them a long time to get to various of these places that were attacked.
So I think that the soldiers that were along the border fought fiercely. They were outnumbered almost in every place. Terrorists arrived with huge amounts of weapons, all of them, by the way, smuggled through the border with Egypt. And the police came pretty fast and stopped the terrorists from moving towards major cities like Ashkelon. But there were so many different areas where there was fighting, and there was only one road connecting all the towns. The terrorists seized the road, and it was very hard to reach.
Amir Avivi, a brigadier general in the Israeli reserves and a former deputy commander of the Gaza Division. Next to Northern Ireland, which is betting big on film, TV and gaming. The TV series Game of Thrones was filmed there, and building on that huge success, Northern Ireland is investing millions of dollars in high-tech production. Indeed, some of Hollywood's biggest stars have been lured from the beaches of Malibu to the Antrim coast. Hannah McCarthy has been for a visit.
Game of Thrones injected tens of millions of dollars into the region's economy, which has struggled to provide high-skilled job opportunities for young people after decades of political conflict. Film director turned technology entrepreneur Hugh McGorry used to teach film at Queen's University in Belfast.
A lot of the students that I was working with ended up getting world-class experience by working at high levels on Game of Thrones.
Much of the HBO series was shot at a studio in the Docklands of Belfast, where the towering yellow cranes of the old shipbuilders Harland and Wolff still pierce the skyline. McGrory says Game of Thrones has had a hugely positive impact on the region.
On its community, but also the impact on tourism and general self-esteem. You have to remember that we're coming out of a long period of conflict.
McGrory says the world of TV and film production is innovating and moving away from traditional film sets and on-site locations.
What's coming is artificial intelligence. This isn't an incremental shift. This is a totally radical shift.
Northern Ireland is eager to be at the forefront of this AI revolution and is developing a studio equipped for world-class TV, film and gaming production.
We are building out one of the, if not the most advanced currently, virtual production studio complexes being built anywhere in the world right now.
At a cost of nearly $100 million, Studio Ulster will open later this year in the Belfast docks. CEO Declan Keeney says it will have pioneering stages encased in walls of high-definition screens.
We can create real light from these walls, and we can film what we call in-camera visual effects.
He says it will transform the way movies are shot.
So, for example, in Belfast, we could create Morocco by bringing in sand and creating, you know, in the round, projecting the horizon in Morocco. And so, you know, it transforms what's possible.
Keeney believes that the economic power of film, TV and gaming is not fully recognised, even though government figures show that the creative industries are worth around $135 billion to the UK.
Creative industries contribute more per year to the economy in the UK and Northern Ireland than if you combined aerospace and life sciences and the automotive sectors.
Most importantly, the Studio Ulster CEO says that the creative sector could stem the brain drain from Northern Ireland, offering young people a chance to stay and work here.
We are creating an environment where you can work on anything from very small scale projects, build your portfolio, your skill sets and your capability, all the way up to AAA productions.
Northern Ireland is hoping, as well as creating more jobs, that the high-tech investment will put it at the cutting edge of virtual and digital screen production in the future.
Hannah McCarthy in Northern Ireland. Still to come.
The flooding here is quite serious. Everything above the ground floor and above were flooded.
In Guangdong, in China, the impact of days of heavy rain and storms. This is the Global News Podcast. For years, groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have been carrying out regular attacks in Africa targeting civilians and the military. Thousands of people have been killed. In West Africa alone, millions of people have been displaced by the violence. Against this backdrop, Nigeria is hosting a summit aimed at improving the continent's response to the insecurity. Our Africa regional editor is Will Ross.
The Nigerian National Security Advisor called the summit in order to basically put across a response that would be coming from right across the continent, a more joined up response to the large number of problems there are, insecurity problems ranging from, of course, the Sahel, where there are these terrible daily attacks by these groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, but right across the continent, Somalia, of course, Al-Shabaab, we hear a lot about. Down in Mozambique, the rise of a jihadist group there in the north of that country. There are basically different officials coming from countries across the continent, government officials, senior UN officials. Interestingly, nobody from Mali, Niger or Burkina Faso. And those three countries, of course, have seen coups in recent years. And the coup leaders have said the reason we're taking power is because of the failure to tackle these jihadist problems.
And there are thousands of international troops working in Africa at the moment as well, trying to help deal with attacks by groups like the ones that you mentioned. But this event, this summit, is about finding African-led solutions, isn't it?
Certainly some of the comments during the summit so far have stressed the need for an Africa solution. I think there has been a feeling amongst some, especially West African countries, that France kind of came in and led the international response. The United States has obviously played a big role as well. And I think some of the countries really want to be able to chart their own course and come up with their own solutions. But of course, then you're into a big problem of funding. Because the Nigerian president, for example, Bola Tinubu, is talking once again about the need for setting up a regional standby force, so a big military force that can be prepared to go in wherever there's a problem. But, I mean, that's going to cost a vast amount of money. We've already had other regional forces that have had limited success. They often require international funding. So it's hard to know where the solution to all this is. The fact is, these armed groups move across the continent, or move certainly across regions, very fast, totally ignoring national borders, often moving around on motorbikes, in cars. They're far quicker. They know the terrain better than the militaries. And the militaries in these different countries simply haven't been able to protect communities from the attack. So quite what the continent can get out of a two-day summit, I've no idea. But there is a need for a radical rethink about how they're going about improving the security. And in the last couple of years, you know, we've seen these coups, we've seen thousands of UN troops, peacekeeping troops, forced to leave Mali. We've seen all these thousands of French troops forced to leave. But what is the solution in place of all these international troops?
Will Ross. Next to China, at least 11 people are missing and tens of thousands have been forced to leave their homes as torrential downpours continue to batter parts of southern China. Days of heavy rain and storms in Guangdong province have led to severe flooding. Several major rivers have reached their highest levels for half a century. Landslides have hit several villages, blocking roads. Weather forecasters in Guangdong are calling the situation very grim.
Like in Yingde and Yangshan, the flooding here is quite serious. Everything above the ground floor and above were flooded. But measures were taken well in advance. Many of the residents had already moved away.
In the last 2 years, the rain has started to get relatively heavy. In the past, the floodwater rarely rose to this point. At least they were drained.
Isabel Hilton is the founder of China Dialogue, a group that examines China's environmental challenges. Rebecca Kesby asked her how unusual the current flooding in Guangdong was.
This is unusual in two respects. As you're absolutely right, there is an annual flood season, in fact, in South China. And it's quite often, the air is quite often hit by typhoons and you know, other tropical storms. But this is 2 months earlier than the usual flood season, and it's much, much heavier. So it's a change in pattern, which of course has big effects on things like agriculture and actually on preparedness.
Well, and this part of China is often known as the world's factory, isn't it? It's got these huge, vast industry areas. The population is enormous. There's a very high migrant worker constituent there as well. Just talk us through what kind of place Guangdong is in this area.
Oh, well, Guangdong province is, as you say, it was one of the very early free zones. So when Deng Xiaoping decided to open China up, he opened in the south first. It made sense because it's just over the border from Hong Kong. A lot of investment came in. A lot of Hong Kong's manufacturing moved to the province, and it just grew and grew and grew. And of course, since those early days where you had very low added value factories, it's moved up the value chain considerably. So now China wants to make it into the kind of Silicon Valley of China. So the Pearl River Delta development is earmarked for much higher end manufacturing and already has some. BYD cars, for example, are made in the province. So it's very, very important to China economically. And as you say, it's very, very densely populated.
And we know that the Chinese authorities have said they've been successful in terms of evacuating people that are at most at risk. But is this something they're going to have to think about long term in terms of climate change and what could happen another time if there's more flooding?
Well, they are. And of course, it's not just this. It's this province that we're looking at the moment. But last year, the floods particularly hit the northwest, the northeast and the capital, Beijing. And what the party tends to do, you know, when there are catastrophic events like this, and they're not infrequent in China, they're getting more severe and they're getting harder to manage. What the party tends to stress is not the lack of preparedness, because that would be politically difficult, but it does stress the rescue that gets mounted. So they send in the People's Liberation Army characteristically, and they have lots of pictures on television of people being rescued. Now, sometimes this plays well and sometimes it plays less well. There was a terrible flood in Zhengzhou in Henan province 3 years ago when the civil defense was really all over the place and people were trying to get home in the middle of a catastrophic flood. Mm. And they were in the underground metro and it flooded. So there were these images of people in underground, stalled underground tube trains with the water rising, and it was very, very bad.
Isabel Hilton, the founder of China Dialogue. Police in Britain have charged two men with spying for China following a counter-terrorism investigation. The pair are accused of breaking the Official Secrets Act. Our security correspondent Gordon Carrera reports.
Christopher Berry, who's 32 and from Witney in Oxfordshire, and Christopher Cash, who's 29 and from London, are charged with offences under Section 1 of the 1911 Official Secrets Act, which relate to obtaining or communicating documents or information which might be useful to an enemy. The offences are alleged to have been carried out between December 2021 and February last year. Commander Dominic Murphy, the head of the Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Command, said it had been an extremely complex investigation into what are very serious allegations. The pair were arrested in March 2023, but news only emerged last September. It was reported then that Mr. Cash was a parliamentary researcher involved with the China Research Group, a body set up by Conservative MPs to promote debate about the country. A statement issued by his lawyers at the time maintained he was innocent. A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy said it reaffirmed its comments from last September that accusations that China was involved in stealing intelligence were completely fabricated and nothing but malicious slander. The two men have been bailed to appear at Westminster Magistrates Court on Friday.
Gordon Carrera. The dating app Grindr is being sued by hundreds of users in the UK for allegedly sharing sensitive information, including HIV status, with third parties. It's the world's largest dating app for LGBT people. Electra Naismith reports.
The data protection lawsuit has been filed at the High Court in London. It accuses Grindr's owners of illegally passing on the personal information of thousands of users to advertisers for commercial purposes. The data shared includes users' HIV status and even the dates of HIV tests. Grindr's Los Angeles-based owners say the lawsuit mischaracterizes past policies. The breaches are alleged to have occurred prior to April 2020 when the company changed its consent mechanism. Grindr is used by an estimated 13 million people worldwide every month. Lawyers say thousands in the UK want to join the claim.
Electra Naismith. Five raccoons are still on the run in the Netherlands, more than a month after escaping from their zoo enclosure. Keepers at the Aqua Zoo in Leeuwarden say they've tried everything to recapture them, including search parties, infrared drones and tempting treats like marshmallows and strawberry juice. Nikki Cardwell is on their trail.
Raccoons are native to North America. They live in wooded areas and eat anything, including the contents of rubbish bins, hence the nickname Trash Bandits. This troop had been living as part of a colony of 200 in woodland on the Netherlands border with Germany, but was captured as part of a crackdown on invasive species. The Aqua Zoo in Leeuwarden was supposed to be their new home, but they clearly had other ideas. On their first night at the zoo, 11 of the troop of 12 dug their way out of their enclosure. Two didn't make it very far. They were found sleeping in a nearby tree. Another was caught in a trap. The prospect of cherry syrup too much to resist. Another three were caught quickly. The remaining five, not a trace. Gone, like trash bandits in the night. The zoo's general manager, Jerome Lumeyer, says they've done everything they can.
The police assisted us with drones, with heat cameras, and they can see all kind of animals like ducks, like seagulls, but no raccoons. We patrolled at night with night vision, with infrared cameras, also with heat cameras again. We placed traps. And some local people helped us. They stayed up during the night. They saw like deers and otters and a beaver. And yeah, they really had good nights seeing all those animals, but no raccoons. It's very hard to find them.
He says now that the high-tech approach has failed and the sweet temptation spurned, they may have to go old school with wanted posters sent to all local residents. Have you seen these raccoons?
Nikki Cardwell reporting, and I hope you enjoyed those raccoon sound effects. I know I did. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.